Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, as you know because you're listening today and it's Wednesday and it's 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about taste. And today we are going to be having that conversation with a tastemaker, let's call him, in New York here. Stan Sagner is the restaurant critic for the New York Daily News, which is actually his moonlighting gig. He is a writer and a consultant and a television expert and a thinker of interesting things. And welcome to the studio, Stan. It's really great to have you here.
Good morning. Good to be here.
So there are so many things I like to talk about restaurant critics, having studied them and under microscopes, let's say. But I just want to ask you, I just want to start talking, what's going on out there? What have you been eating lately? What excites you about the New York restaurant scene right now?
What excites me? There have been so many great new restaurants in Queens.
Queens?
Yeah.
How can you say that sitting here in Brooklyn at Roberta's? I mean, geez.
I think Brooklyn has already staked its claim, and that's Brooklyn is the new Manhattan, and Queens is the new Brooklyn.
Okay.
Yeah.
So great restaurants in Queens, and I suppose you don't mean Ecuadorian restaurants or Hunanese restaurants, which we sort of think of. Of eating in Queens, but something...
There's a lot of great ethnic food, and there's terrific Mexican, there's great Chinese, but there are starting to be some really good fine dining restaurants. I think it's a lot of it is driven by real estate.
Right.
As I'm sure you're aware of, is that the cost of opening a restaurant in Manhattan has become prohibitive, and in desirable locations in Brooklyn, the same thing, and Queens is a new frontier. And I think also there's a migration due to housing.
Right. So, and are there neighborhoods that you here we are in Bushwick, and Williamsburg obviously has become a brand. are there neighborhoods you think where there are seeds that might spread and populate?
It's starting right now, sort of in the predictable places in Astoria and Flushing, but mm-hmm. I think it's going to branch out from there as well.
Well, that's cool. Talk about the reviewing. I think that when I first started out in the food world, which was a long time ago, there were two or three reviewers. Everyone knew who they were. Everyone knew what they liked to eat. Everyone, they had sort of built up a following, and once in a while, one of them changed. But I don't think that's the case anymore, is it? I mean, obviously, there is Pete Wells out there, but there's you, and there's every blogger on Earth, and there's everyone with a smartphone and a camera. And how do you see, where do you fit into all the noise about restaurants and restaurant recommendations?
I'm part of the noise. I think Pete and to a large extent, Adam Platt are sort of the Mount Everest of that that category. And then you have everyone else. And in my case, I write for a daily newspaper in New York. We have a fairly sizable readership. But in terms of the echo chamber effect and the residual resonance and just impact that those two reviewers have, we don't have. And I actually find that liberating. Mm. It allows me to be anonymous, as far as I know. More or less.
So there will be no pictures of Stan taken today or posted on our Facebook?
No, I'm still...
He's sitting actually wearing a muumuu in a shadow so that we don't recognize him.
With
here.
A bag over my head like Shia LaBeouf.
Right.
Which I think allows us as journalists to be honest. And to take chances on restaurants that we might otherwise not pursue. And you know, and restaurants and PR people are constantly on the lookout for Pete and for Adam, and I think they're less concerned about us, and that allows us to really be pure as we can be. And you know, the bloggers have a very different agenda, and I think that some of them are earnest, and I think some of them are somewhat predatory. And they use the platform that they have to extract something from the restaurants that, you know, for the time being, as a journalist, I can't and don't want to do.
Indeed. So let's talk about the liberation that you feel because some of the pressure is off allows you to what? To go to talk a little bit more about that, like what you feel when you decide where to go and then when you sit down to write about it. What's the liberating thing of being anonymous? Because it's actually, I mean, Adam Platt has put that question front and center by putting his picture on the cover of the paper.
And I think in his case it was sort of moot because he's recognizable and everyone's on the lookout for him, and I think he just sort of was taking the obvious and dealing with it. In my case, you know, I've existed in this world long enough that if you really went to great effort, you could go on social media and find pictures of me, and I suppose, you know, you could do that for almost anyone else. But there's enough of us out there that would be a full-time job for the restaurant. I think they really want to focus on making good food and keeping their clients happy. So in terms of where I fit on the totem pole, I'm a lot lower, and so they don't put that much effort into it. It gives me the freedom, first of all, to not wonder or be distracted by whether the restaurant is going through contortions to try to give me special treatment or food. And I've discovered on enough occasions that based on where I'm sitting or how long I wait for my entree to arrive, that I am certainly not getting special treatment. And so,
which is how most people eat in restaurants. That's
right. Yeah, and I think that's my job, or at least that's my objective, which is that I am there as a surrogate for the everyman who has worked very, you know, I sort of put this hat on of I'm the guy who just worked all week at a job that I probably don't like all that much and have a boss who doesn't treat me very well, and I'm taking my girlfriend out for a really nice dinner on a Friday night that's costing me an arm and a leg, and am I getting my money's worth? And is this an experience that's worth repeating, and would I recommend this to someone else? And that's sort of how I approach it. But by the same token, I come from a food background. I was trained as a chef. I've cooked professionally. And I know how hard it is to do that job and to do it consistently and how much effort goes into cooking and running a restaurant, and no one sets out to make a bad meal,
right?
And no one who is entirely sane goes out to become a chef. You have to have a screw loose, in my view.
So, and sorry, I
you know, so it's a career of passion, and so, you know, people do it because they love it, and they try to do it well, and sometimes it doesn't work out, and I think the perspective that I bring, which is not really the answer to your question, but the perspective that I bring or hope to bring, is that I have some notion of what goes on back there. And so I'm very cautious about the criticism that I may bring, the negative criticism, because, you know, I know what went into it, or I have, you know, some idea of what went into it. And if it's not successful, there's usually a reason. And I try to find the good along with the bad. So, I don't take any pleasure in a negative review.
Although your readers might.
Yeah, they do. They're more fun to write in some ways, but it's painful to put that out there because it's a painful thing to read for the restaurateur, for the chef. And I guess that's what's liberating, is that I don't feel like a review that I might write is going to have the sort of titanic influence that one that Pete Wells might write or that Adam might write, which could theoretically deal a death blow to a restaurant. I just don't have that.
But force. You've said several interesting things. I'd like to underscore a little bit. One, first of all, and this is a question I'll put as a question to you. Is it really Pete Wells and Adam Platt, or is it the New York Times and New York Magazine? Because, of course, they come and go, and is it? I mean, I would think it's the position more than anything.
I think you know the answer by the way you posed the question. I think in the case of Pete Wells, it's the New York Times. I think if Pete Wells, he's been at it for a relatively short period of time. But it is the force of the New York Times, and I think whoever gets put in that chair has disproportionate influence. Adam Platt has been at it for a very, very long time, so he's as much a brand as New York Magazine. So in that case, it's a slightly different equation. But yes, it's the same thing with the New York Times when it comes to reviewing a play. If they trash a play, that play is likely going to close in a week. It doesn't quite have that effect on restaurants, and some restaurants are bulletproof, but I'm not going to close a restaurant, and I don't want to close a restaurant.
But my corollary to that question, though, is that no one that I can think of who's had either of those roles has ever been a chef or cooked professionally in a kitchen. And I've studied these folks, so I'm not making that up. And so I would think that in some ways among the industry, that gives you, if not influence, not the same impact, let's say, but certainly a degree of respect. Because as you said, it's your evaluation. To me, what's always missing about restaurants is an understanding of how restaurants work, which you have had. I think that's a really unique proposition.
That's very kind. I mean, that was the reason why I was hired, at least that's what I was told by the editor at the time, is that I brought that perspective that he felt that decades of writing experience were not as important as bringing some perspective that most people in the role don't have. I had some writing experience, but not to the extent as some of my colleagues. Answers
that's it. So how long have you been doing it?
Going on a little over 2 years.
And what is different from when you started, say, when you were in the kitchen and thought you were going to write about restaurants? What has proven surprising to you in those 2 years, or good or bad?
It's mostly bad. A little bit of it has been good. I'd say what's changed, and it's changed during the time that I've been doing it. I mean, it's evolved very quickly, is partially the pressure of blogs and the internet and sites like Eater and Grub Street, and is that there is very fierce competition, and I think it's actually unhealthy, but it's a reality, to cover restaurants faster and faster and faster, which it trickles up to a certain extent, and it affects everyone, including the New York Times, to review restaurants sooner than I think might be in everyone's best interest.
So say more about that. Because, of course, as a reader of New York Magazine or whatever we're talking about, we want to know, you know.
So
I'm goading you.
Yeah. So, for example, I mean, you can pick almost anything. But, you know, when Paul Liebrandt's restaurant, the Elm, I was confusing with that. When the Elm opened, there was this frenzy to cover it. He's a very talented, very tempestuous chef, and within a very short period of time from its opening, virtually every major outlet had covered it, and either in a review or in some blog post or some sort of profile. And a restaurant needs time to get its legs, and the kitchen needs to sort of refine itself. It's a new staff always that's been assembled, and there's an organic quality to these people working together, and certain menu items don't quite work right at first, and there's issues with plating and sourcing and timing, and the front of house has to get their act together. So to review a restaurant in its first 2 weeks or 4 weeks or even 6 weeks is, in my view, it's grossly unfair. Right. But if we don't do it, then by the time we do it, if we were to cover it at the 3-month mark, which would be preferable in my view, you know, I'll be the last person left. And at that point, nobody's interested in reading it, and my editors aren't interested in me writing it. So I try to strike as good a balance as I can in there and try to bear in mind the fact that there's certain things that may not be perfect and are not worthy of calling them out on it simply because...
Well, there's a place I would think that your experience in restaurants would come in handy to know, to see what's going on, which is systemic, let's say, a challenge, or what is just not quite ready.
Yeah. And I learned that lesson the hard way. I did a review fairly early on and was, I'd rather not say the restaurant.
Okay.
And, I mean, I guess if you want to research it, you can probably figure it out, but it was a tough review of a restaurant that I thought had promise, and I indicated that in the review. But I was fairly critical of it, and I was immediately taken to task by industry people who felt that I had been just grossly unfair in having reviewed it at that point in its life. It had been open for about 5-6 weeks, and although some of the food showed promise, the service was a mess, and more importantly, I felt that food was being sent out that, although conceptually was good or had the potential to be good, it wasn't being tasted, it wasn't being seasoned, it wasn't being checked, and it was very slapdash. And I still stand behind the review because I felt that, again, as wearing my hat as the consumer, I'm paying $150, $200 for this meal. And it's not my fault that you've been open for 5 weeks and you should sort of be ready on day one. But that being said, you try to be more understanding.
I'm going to hold you there. We need to take a quick break.
Sure.
I'm talking with Stan Sagner, who, among many other things, is the restaurant critic for the New York Daily News. And you're listening to Taste Matters.
This is Let Me In by Snowmine on heritageradionetwork.org. Just wanted, that's needed, makes me let it fall. But you let me in, and I don't want it. But you make me believe it, so do I really.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
That seemed to be several musical interludes strung together with the commercial. Several genres, anyway. Welcome back. You're listening to Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking to Stan Sagner, who's the restaurant critic for the New York Daily News. Let's shift gears a little bit away from the process of reviewing restaurants and talk about... I still want to get out of you some things that you enjoy. You also write about trends in food and do sort of different sorts of pieces from... criticism. Tell me what you see going on, dishes you've enjoyed lately, things that people can look forward to coming to a restaurant near them sometime soon.
Kale. That's probably a refrain that you're getting every week. No.
Everywhere. Kale.
I think kale's...
What's the next kale? That's the question everyone wants to know.
Yeah, what's the next kale? I think uni is already... last year's kale. It seems to be everywhere. I mean, when it starts to show up at Kentucky Fried Chicken, then we'll know that it's fully jumped the shark. I tell you what I would hope would be the next kale, and one is goat. and it's
sorry, you vegetarians out there, but yeah,
yeah.
Okay, why?
Well, I first of all, that opens another sort of topic, which is cultural barriers to certain foods, my family's from Argentina, and that's a very common protein down there, and I've discovered through my eating experience, both professionally and personally, that virtually everywhere around the world, it's a very common protein, right. And in India and in parts of Asia and all over Africa and Latin America. And
even Italy, actually.
And even Italy and Spain. And it's delicious and it's lean and it's healthy and it is incredibly versatile. And if you mention it in this country, people kind of freak out.
Interesting.
And I had a brief conversation with the chef at M. Wells and Hugh, and we talked about the fact that there are these cultural barriers here and throughout the world. I mean, it's all sort of localized to pursuing certain foods that, you know, that are really fantastic.
So, right. So you're two things.
I didn't answer your question.
No, but that's a good one, because one, you don't know this probably, but I have this radio show because of Goat, and that's a whole other story. That I was actually stopped on the street by Patrick Martins, the founder of Heritage Radio Network and Heritage Foods USA, who was delivering 9 goats in a car, and he almost hit me and said, "Hey, you should have a radio show." But regardless of that,
we're going to do that on my radio show. Yeah, we'll talk about that story.
Exactly. But you are posing an idea to me that is something I personally have written about and that I'm fascinated by. And this is, you know, is the role of the restaurant critic to be the consumer, to subscribe to the tastes and sort of weigh in on what people like and want and might be the average person? Or is it to sort of plant the seed of some aspiration for, you know, what taste could be, things you might want to try? So I know we began the show when you said that you like to be this anonymous person, the guy who's going out for dinner.
Yeah.
Do you also want to lead that person to Goat, is my question? Do you think that's your role?
That's a great question. I think it depends on the reviewer, and it depends on their personality, their taste, and their audience, and what they hope to achieve with their audience. I think, for me personally, I don't really want to, or I'm not interested in reflecting on what the trends are. I mean, it's a secondary thing. I mean, I do notice that there are certain dishes that seem to appear everywhere and ingredients that appear everywhere. And probably as a newspaper journalist, I should pay more attention to those things and emphasize them more. But they're just not that interesting to me, because they're just not. But in terms of nudging readers to try things that they might otherwise not try, I think that sort of is a natural corollary to what I do, because that's the way that I eat. Mm. And sometimes I probably shouldn't. I should probably, in certain places, stick with the basics and compare. You know, if you go to Scarpetta, he does spaghetti and tomato sauce with basil. It's as basic and base as you can get. And it's a fantastic dish that most people would shy away from because they think, I can do this at home. Well, you can't. his tomatoes are 3D. His basil is 4D. I'm naturally drawn to things that are to dishes and that I think are a little bit out of the mainstream, and game and organ meats and things like that, which again for vegetarians, apologies, but
so there was this great. I mean, you mentioned Paul Liebrandt and the Elm, but in a very interesting moment when he first came to New York to make a splash, mm-hmm. Good and Bad, it was actually Jonathan. Whose name just left my mind. The great writer, Jonathan Gold, the great food writer and critic, who coined the term critic bait for what he was doing then, who sort of in an argument with William Grimes, who was then the New York Times critic, who just thought everything on Paul Grimes' menu was not genius, but was this sort of critic bait, this trying to lead people to this other place. Do you think that
I think that there are dishes like that, and there are menus that are entirely like that, and that they're intellectual exercise. We're not on broadcast, and I think I can say this. They're they're masturbatory. I mean, they're just it's this indulgent or self-indulgent expression of the chef that doesn't make a lot of sense on the palate, and I think is intended either as sort of this egotistical
masturbatory egotistical dishes.
There's a theme here. expression or it's critic bait or they're trying to get buzz. But the dishes in and of themselves don't make a lot of sense. I don't think that's the sort of thing I tend to go for. But if, I mean, there is a certain logic to a dish. And I think that's part of the context that I bring to it. And if it's not there, you can almost tell by looking at the menu that it's not there. And sometimes I'll try it and sometimes I won't. And if it doesn't make sense, then I'll be clear about it. But I was just at Alonda, which is, you know, everybody is reviewing and was long delayed. And they have a dish that's getting a tremendous amount of buzz, which is their bucatini with smoked uni. It's a fantastic dish. And it probably is critic bait, but it makes sense, and it's just a beautiful dish, and uni is everywhere. But
is it maybe either uni or a goat or the new kale? Yeah.
but to me anyway, it's a great dish, and I would hope that people would overcome their reticence to eat that ingredient and try it, and that would be the sort of dish that I would highlight. Yeah,
great. In the last minute or two, I'm wondering, having sort of worked both sides of the line, let's say, being in the kitchen and now sort of reviewing restaurants from the dining room, is there any advice in a minute you'd give to chefs or restaurateurs out there, things that you think they, just because it's difficult to know what the experience of eating in someone's restaurant is, besides to stop masturbating with your ego testicles on the menu.
We got to edit this out.
I think all those words are actually legitimate words from the FCC's point of view, but anyway, they don't listen.
I'd say two quick things. One is going back further, is that if you're considering a career in cooking, give it some real serious thought, because you will start as a cook, not as a chef. And the path to being a chef is a long and very, very hard one, an arduous one, and you're going to make tremendous sacrifice, both personal and financial and physical, to get there. And the illusion that's created on television, which is the attraction for a lot of would-be cooks and chefs, is it's an illusion. And to really accomplish your goals and really make an impact, you're talking about a 5 to 7 to 10 year road, where you're not going to be spending Christmas or Thanksgiving with your loved ones. And then from the chef's side, who are already out there, I guess, there's a lot of things I could suggest, but one of them is to give some real thought and actually sit down and experience the food that you're serving, in a linear way. And what is it like to eat this dish? And don't just sort of taste it the way you do in the kitchen, but sit down at the table and eat it the way that that your guest is going to eat it. Because I've had many dishes that conceptually, again, have the potential of being really impressive, and some of them even great, but they don't make any sense on the plate. There's no way to eat them that is sort of fun or comfortable for the guest. And if you don't, you know, spear it in exactly the right way, in the right order, you know, you get a mouthful of just nonsense, because you're missing an ingredient that balances out, because it's on the far end of the plate, but it's all been plated as this beautiful still life, but it isn't from a sensory experience very logical or pleasant.
Okay. Did you hear that, chefs? Because Stan Zagner might be coming, and he doesn't want the sour to be on the other side of the plate to balance that out. And I think that's great advice. I do think that personally, I would agree. I feel like eating is a skill and cooking is a skill, and they don't always go together. They're not always in the same place.
Don't overthink it.
So thank you, Stan, for joining us and for overthinking it a little bit just for 30 minutes here.
Pleasure.
Next week, this is a perfect segue, because next week we're going to welcome a conversation with an incredibly overthinking, but in a good way, chef, Matt Leitner of Atera, who was one of the purveyors of the long tasting menu and the counter setting at over combining unusual ingredients in unexpected ways. And it might be critic bait or it might be genius. And it's certainly an interesting and going to be a great conversation. Until then, why don't you go to a restaurant and think about evaluating it from the perspective of a reviewer, about what you would tell your friends, not what would get you a free meal the next time as a blogger, perhaps, but what you think would be important to add to this conversation about taste that we here think is so important for all of us. And until then, I'm Mitchell Davis, and this is Taste Matters.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.